are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Greetings again. This is Bob Mallon with Military News. Thank you for joining me. Let's get right away to where we're going. First, articles from military.com, our usual website. The headline, Army four-star who pressured panel to help career of unfit officer suspended, facing Pentagon investigation. Published by military.com, authored by Steve Bannon, March 22, 2024. Army Secretary Christine Wormuth suspended one of the service's top generals Friday after military.com reporting revealed he may have inappropriately intervened in a service assignment panel's work in an attempt to help the career of a subordinate officer who was deemed unfit to command. The case of General Charles Hamilton, who oversees Army Material Command, was also referred by the Army to the Defense Department Inspector General for investigation, a rare move to take against a seasoned four-star general. This week, Secretary of the Army Christine Wormuth became aware of credible allegations General Charles Hamilton, Commanding General of Army Material Command, AMAC, interfered in the Army's Command Assignment Program, CAP, process last fall. Colonel Randy Farrell, a spokesman for Wormuth, told Military.com in a statement, adding that Hamilton had been suspended pending the outcome of the Pentagon and any other subsequent investigations. Lieutenant General Chris Mohan, Deputy Commander of AMC, will serve in Hamilton's place for the remaining time. Military.com's investigation found that Hamilton used what one general with direct knowledge of the situation called a pressure campaign aimed at influencing the Army's Command Assessment Program panel in support of a female lieutenant colonel who was seeking a battalion command post. The assessment process is specifically designed to eliminate outside influence. Despite Hamilton's effort, which included contacting panel members, the assessment process, which is designed to validate whether an officer is fit for command, found the lieutenant colonel unqualified due to ineffective and counterproductive leadership. However, Hamilton's subordinate officer was later placed on a selection list for command despite rejection by two assessment panels. Following Military.com's reporting this week on Hamilton's actions, she will no longer be a candidate to take command and will have to recompete next year. The lieutenant colonel's name is being withheld because Military.com found no evidence of wrongdoing on her part. For its investigation, Military.com interviewed key Army staff and officials, including general officers who were directly familiar with the Lieutenant Colonel's command assessment panels. Hamilton's conduct was viewed as so out of line that the director of the assessment panel, Colonel Robert O'Brien, penned a memo with a detailed timeline of events, which the publication also reviewed. O'Brien did not return requests for comment. Hamilton's lobbying campaign. It started with closed-door meetings between Hamilton and staff with the Army's Command Assessment Program, or CAP, in Washington, D.C., at its annual Association of the United States Army Convention. The event is a massive gathering of who's who in the service, held every October. The Lieutenant Colonel's 1st Battalion Commander Assessment Program, or BICAP, panel was held later that month. BICAP includes a series of assessments of a Lieutenant Colonel's command potential, including a physical fitness test, examination of communication skills, psychological evaluation, and a panel of 5 randomly selected generals doing a blind interview with the candidate. The assessment panelists are not supposed to know the candidate's name and very little about her background. The candidate is also behind a curtain, the idea being that the service wants to take every measure possible to prevent bias. Panelists are also selected just hours before the panel in an effort to prevent lobbying. On October 30, the Lieutenant Colonel had her BICAP assessment panel at Fort Knox, Kentucky. The process was monitored by Hamilton at his request, a move officials explained is technically allowed but bizarre. By a vote of 0-5, the panel members voted that the Lieutenant Colonel be uncertified for command, citing counterproductive leadership. Hamilton took issue with psychologists' characterization of the Lieutenant Colonel's mental state ahead of the panel, arguing it was too negative. He demanded a second panel, an unheard-of move that is against the Army's own rules, which dictate that a failed BICAP candidate has to wait a year for another chance. O'Brien granted the repanel solely based on Hamilton's request, according to his own memo. However, the Lieutenant Colonel was told by Colonel Townley Hedrick, Command Assessment Program Deputy Chief of Staff, that she was being repaneled due to technical issues. Hamilton later called Hedrick, thanking him for playing a part. The repanel was rescheduled for November 1st, 2 days after her first failed assessment. In the lead-up to that panel, Hamilton called at least 3 of the 5 panel members, who are intended to be anonymous to avoid outside influence, Major Generals Jeff Ray, Trevor Brandenkamp, and Hope Rampe, to discuss the Lieutenant Colonel. Meanwhile, sources with direct knowledge of the situation told Military.com it is unclear whether Hamilton called the other two panel members or even attempted to make contact. Throughout the entire day of the second panel, starting in the early morning until 9 p.m., Hamilton sent a barrage of text messages to O'Brien and Hedrick asking about the results, according to O'Brien's memo. The second panel wrapped up at noon, and the Lieutenant Colonel was again found unfit for command, this time in a 2-3 vote. It's unclear when these results were shared with Hamilton or if Command Assessment Program staff ever responded to his requests. BICAP was supposed to be clean. The news of Hamilton's attempt to subvert the subversive's command selection process roiled the Army from the rank and file to senior staff at the Pentagon, with one senior Army official characterizing Hamilton's conduct to Military.com as a cartoonish example of corrupt judgment. After the investigation of Hamilton, the service says it will review its command assessment process. Following the completion of the Inspector General's work, the Army will undertake an additional review of CAP itself and the entirety of the command selection process to determine what additional steps may be needed to ensure maximum fairness and integrity in the command selection process, Farrell added. Army officials have described to military.com that the service went through a painstakingly detailed process to assure BICAP was about as impenetrable from manipulation as possible. Most of the officials, including half a dozen senior officers interviewed, contend that BICAP is still a solid way to find officers, but that Hamilton's conduct revealed weaknesses in the process. A perfect hiring process just doesn't exist, but this is the best we have, and we have a lot of safeguards here, one general explained to military.com on the condition of anonymity, because they were not authorized to talk to the media on the subject. But this whole event shows we have to work on stuff and things to do. I'm still a believer in BICAP. I want it to survive. But we certainly need to look at how we can prevent this from ever happening again. BICAP started in 2020 and was largely seen across the force as the most significant improvement to how the Army selects battalion commanders. Posts at that level are among the most consequential in the service, where the Pentagon's big picture and the management of frontline troops actually meet. We spend more time and more money on selecting a private to be in 75th Ranger Regiment than we do selecting what I would agree is one of the most consequential leadership positions in the Army, our battalion commanders, General James McConville, who at the time was the service's top officer, said during the development of the program. Meanwhile, generals are rarely disciplined in meaningful ways, let alone publicly. However, Warmoth has fired senior officers for smaller offenses. Among the most recent four stars to be relieved was General Kevin Byrnes in 2005. He led the Army's Training and Doctrine Command, or TRADOC. The New York Times reported at the time that the firing was due to a consensual adulterous affair. General Stanley McChrystal, effectively, had a forced resignation in 2010 after a Rolling Stone article painted a picture of the general and his top aides making snide comments about then Vice President Joe Biden and other top Obama administration officials. How senior leaders respond will be very telling, another general told military.com. If Hamilton is guilty, he should be relieved and retired under grade reduction. Now here's another interesting article from military.com. It's headlined, Finding Money: How the Pentagon Dug Down and Found $300 Million for Ukraine, but is still deep in the red. This was published by the Associated Press, Lolita C. Baldor and Tara Corp, March 23, 2024. Dateline Washington. Even with a budget of more than $800 billion and the ability to buy millions of weapons and pieces of equipment every year, the Pentagon sometimes can find a few dollars in the couch cushions or make that $300 million. For the second time in 9 months, Defense Department accountants have sharpened their pencils, pored over their books, and found a way to send more money to Ukraine. The $300 million figure may sound huge to ordinary citizens who struggle to pay the mortgage, but it's not for the Pentagon. Given the vast size of the military budget, even minor savings like shaving a few dollars off every bullet in a new contract can translate into millions of dollars. That's how White House and Pentagon leaders explained how they could send a new package of weapons and equipment to Ukraine this month, even though the bill to fund military aid is stalled in Congress. It was the first aid package since late December, and the lack of U.S. weapon deliveries have caused Ukrainian troops on the front lines to ration or run out of ammunition. A senior defense official said the department used savings it recouped in an army contract that came in cheaper than planned. The official spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss details of the process. The discovery of the $300 million has raised some eyebrows. The Defense Department is begging Congress for money it needs to replace weapons it already sent to Ukraine earlier this month. The Pentagon revealed how bad the gap was, $10 billion. That means that the military services that sent stockpiled equipment to Ukraine won't get replacements until Congress improves the funding bill, which House Republicans have stalled. It is unclear whether the Pentagon could have put the $300 million toward reducing the $10 billion replacement deficit instead. There are congressional controls on how different funding lines can be used, and the Pentagon did not immediately respond to questions on the savings, but with Ukrainian troops running out of ammunition in their fight against Russia, and no signs that the funding impasse in Congress will end soon, the Biden administration opted to use the savings to help its struggling ally. Adding to the complicated financial record keeping, the Pentagon announced last year it had found an accounting error that freed up an extra $6.2 billion in weapons for Ukraine. The military service used replacement costs to determine the value of the equipment sent to Ukraine, but rules require them to use net book value, which is somewhat lower. The surplus was in spending authority, not actual money, so it meant the Pentagon had congressional approval to send an additional $6.2 billion worth of equipment to Ukraine. A look at the complicated accounting follows. The $10 billion hole. The $10 billion replenishment gap stems from estimates that Pentagon budgeteers made in the early months of the war. Back then, there were few details on what weapons Ukrainian would need over time and what the U.S. would ultimately send. In those early months, mostly simple systems like small arms ammunition and anti-tank rounds were rushed into Ukraine. For those simpler systems, the Pentagon's replenishment costs were estimated to be close to a 1-to-1 ratio. But as the months went by, the U.S. began to send entire air defense systems, armored vehicles, sophisticated missiles, even Abrams tanks. The replacement cost ratio grew depending on the system, sometimes to as much as 4-to-1. because the military, in some cases, is replacing older weapons with newer, higher tech, and pricier ones. For example, the Army sent Humvees to Ukraine, but is buying new and far more expensive joint light tactical vehicles to replace them. The Army also is buying the upcoming Precision Strike Missile, or the PRSM, to replace the Long Range Army Technical Missile System, or the ATACMS, which is in high demand in Ukraine and costs less, of course, than the PRSM. As a result, the early estimates for how much it would cost to replenish U.S. stockpiles fell short. By how much, however, is difficult to calculate. The Pentagon has not provided any details to explain how it came up with the $10 billion figure, such as the total value of equipment already sent and how much the department needs to replenish. And as to that $300 million savings, as the U.S. began negotiating contracts to replace weapons sent to Ukraine, officials at times were able to save money by getting things at lower prices than initially expected. For example, the military was able to buy 25-millimeter ammunition for $93 a round, rather than the initial estimate of $130 a round. So, when it bought 120,000 rounds, the savings on that contract alone was $4.4 million. Such savings actually happen all the time, as do contract overages. Over the past 2 years, the military services returned more than $1.57 billion to the replenishment fund as of September 2023 due to price savings or other contract issues. Of the funds returned, about $1.5 billion were used to replace other stocks sent to Ukraine, while the remaining $70 million came too late in the fiscal year and expired before it could be reprogrammed. The senior defense official said the bulk of the $300 million came from an Army contract to buy armored multipurpose vehicles. The final cost was $290 million, less than they initially estimated. Essentially, the recovered $300 million allows the Pentagon to offset the cost of sending more munitions to Ukraine without going deeper into the red. Next, we come to the $6.2 billion surprise. Late last June, as the end of the fiscal year was nearing and congressional funding for Ukraine was beginning to dwindle, Pentagon officials announced they'd found an accounting error. The account in question involved the Pentagon's Presidential Drawdown Authority, or the PDA. That program gives the department the authority to pull weapons from its own stockpiles and send them to Ukraine. It does not provide funding. That comes in other appropriations bills. As the military services pulled weapons off the shelves, they used replacement costs to calculate the value of the equipment sent, rather than book value, as is lawfully required. The book value of a weapon is the original cost minus depreciation, which was a lot less than weapon replacement costs. And once the costs were corrected, there was about a $6.2 billion in spending authority left over. So that brings up the question of what's left. The Pentagon dipped into that unexpectedly discovered $6.2 billion a few times to add additional weapons to Ukraine, and there is currently about 3.91 billion left. In theory, that could be used for sending arms from U.S. stockpiles to Ukraine, but because there is no money left to buy replacement weapons and no guarantee that Congress will act soon, the Pentagon is reluctant to use that authority. Sending weapons without the funding would only deepen the $10 billion replenishment hole, further reducing stockpiles and potentially putting U.S. troops at risk. In the past week, top Pentagon officials have publicly urged Congress to approve a $95 billion supplemental funding package that is still stalled on Capitol Hill. About $60 billion of that would fund U.S. efforts to support Ukraine, with $20 billion of it going toward replenishing stockpiles now and in the future. The officials argue that such funding actually is a boon to Congress, since it would be used to increase production at manufacturing plants all around the U.S. Last week, General C.Q. Brown, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, pressed the point during a rare trip with lawmakers. He took Republican House and Senate members from Arkansas and Oklahoma, some of whom have opposed the spending bill with him, to visit companies in those states, making weapons needed by Ukraine to show that the bill, if passed, would ultimately benefit the local economies and workforces that make up the U.S. defense industrial base. Now here, from military.com, is another article you're liable to find terribly interesting. Fired Navy sub skipper was arrested for drunk driving. So he's the third commander relieved after alcohol incidents this year. Posted military.com, Konstantinian Toropin, March 22, 2024. A recently fired Navy guided missile submarine commander was arrested for driving with a blood alcohol content three times the legal limit, less than a week before he was relieved of command, police records show. Captain Kurt Belagna, who until last week was the commanding officer of the USS Ohio's Sub-Gold crew, was arrested March 5th by Washington State Police for driving with a blood alcohol content of 0.24%. The legal limit is 0.08%. Belanga is the third commander the Navy has relieved this year for driving under the influence. Another submarine commander was relieved in January, and a Navy SEAL commander was fired this week. Task and Purpose was the first outlet to report the details of Belagna's arrest. A Navy spokesman told military.com that despite the recent spike in DUIs among its commanders, the service is not connected or concerned that it indicates a growing problem or trend. Indeed, the spokesman noted that there is no change in the U.S. Navy accountability policy and reiterated the usual statement that the service's commander are expected to uphold the highest standards of responsibility, reliability, and leadership, and the Navy holds them accountable when they fall short of these standards. That's the usual statement. Police records reviewed by military.com show Balagna was driving at an interstate heading into downtown Seattle when he was pulled over by Washington State Police for swerving in and out of his lane and onto the shoulder, and at one point riding the highway rumble strip for a couple of seconds. at around 12:30 p.m. March 5th. According to the officer's narrative in the arrest record, Belagna said he was coming from the town where he lived and heading to Seattle-Tacoma International Airport. However, by the time he was pulled over, he had overshot the airport. He told police officers that he was having some trouble finding it, finding the airport, that is. The police officer immediately noticed signs that the Navy officer was drunk. He noted in his narrative that Belanga's face was flushed, there was a strong odor of intoxicants, and his speech was slurred. After being asked to step out of the car, Belanga admitted to drinking vodka, stating that he started drinking around 8 o'clock that morning, the report said. Then, after Belanga failed some field sobriety tests, the police officer asked him if he thought he should be driving right now. He looked down and shook his head and said no, the report said. Belagna was arrested, and jail records show he was booked on a single DUI charge and spent about 8 hours in the King County Jail before being released minutes before midnight on March 5th. Military.com was not able to reach Belagna for comment by phone. At the moment, it appears that the Navy has fired 5 commanding officers, including Belagna, in 2024. Navy officials have previously said the service relieved 15 commanding officers in 2023. The Navy typically does not offer many details about why it relieves its commanding officers, and its press releases lean on the boilerplate response of loss of confidence as the reasons for firing. However, officials will usually confirm incidents like arrests as connected to a relief it discovered by reporters. Belagna is the 3rd commanding officer in 2024 to have been revealed by press reports as facing DUI charges. While the Navy spokesman who spoke with Military.com said the recent spate of drunk driving charges is not being viewed as atypical, it is challenging to independently assess that claim, given the current policies in place. More details are not known about the other submarine commander who was relieved over a drunk driving charge this year, but the Navy SEAL Captain and Navy Special Warfare Group Commander's court-martial reveals suggest his blood alcohol was around double the legal limit at the time of his arrest. In the absence of details, firings become a kind of Rorschach test, allowing them to be pressed into service as evidence of everything from political pressure on the military that quickly starts to verge on the conspiratorial to critiques of the Navy's high standards for its commanders. They also lead to rampant speculation, and even those connected to the military say the policy of not offering details leads to a loss of confidence in the leadership of the branches. Many officials from a variety of services have told Military.com in conversations that they often have to balance factors like possible ongoing investigations, a commander's right to privacy, and a public right to know in their calculations about what to disclose and when to disclose it. And here comes another article about money from Military.com. This headline is Biden signs $1.2 trillion funding package after Senate's early morning passage ended the shutdown threat. Posted by the Associated Press, Colleen Long, Kevin Fricking, and Mary Claire Jelinek, published the 24th of March, 2024. Dateline, Wilmington, Delaware. President Joe Biden on Saturday signed a $1.2 trillion package of spending bills after Congress had passed the long overdue legislation just hours earlier, ending the threat of a partial government shutdown. This agreement represents a compromise, which means neither side got everything it wanted, Biden said in a statement, but it rejects extreme cuts from House Republicans and expands access to child care, invests in cancer research, funds mental health and subsequent use care, advances American leadership abroad, and provides resources to secure the border. That's the good news for the American people. Parenthetically, my opinion is it doesn't talk about all the pork that's in there also. It took lawmakers 6 months into the current budget year to get near the finish line on government funding. The process slowed by conservatives who pushed for more policy mandates and steeper spending cuts than a Democrat-led Senate or White House would even consider. The impasse requires several short-term spending bills to keep agencies funded. The White House said Biden signed the legislation at his home in Wilmington, Delaware, where he was spending the weekend. It had cleared the Senate by 74-24 vote, shortly after funding had expired for the agencies at midnight. But the White House had sent out a notice shortly after the deadline, announcing that the Office of Management and Budget had ceased shutdown preparations because there was a high degree of confidence that Congress would pass the legislation and the Democratic president would sign it on Saturday from his home in Delaware. The first package of full-year spending bills, which funded the Department of Veterans Affairs, Agriculture, and the Interior, among others, cleared Congress 2 weeks ago with just hours to spare before funding expired for these agencies. The second covered the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, and State, as well as other aspects of general government. When combining the two packages, discretionary spending for the budget year will come to about $1.66 trillion. That does not include programs for Social Security and Medicare, or financing the country's rising debt, which you may recall from last week, every 100 and some hours has an interest payment due of $1 trillion. On Ukraine aid, which Biden and his administration have argued was critical and necessary to help stop Russia's invasion, the package provided $300 million under the defense spending umbrella. That funding is separate from a large assistance package for Ukraine and Israel that is bogged down on Capitol Hill. Biden, in his statement, again pressed Congress to pass additional aid. The House must pass the bipartisan national security supplement to advance our national security interests, and Congress must pass the bipartisan border security agreement, the toughest and fairest reforms in decades, to ensure we have the policies and funding needed to secure the border. It's time to get this done. A bipartisan border package collapsed last month when Republican senators scuttled months of negotiations with Democrats on legislation intended to cut back record numbers of illegal border crossings. To win over support from Republicans, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of LA, Los Angeles that is, pointed to some of the spending increases secured for about 8,000 more detention beds for migrants awaiting their immigration procedures or awaiting removal from the country. That's about a 24% increase from current levels. Also, GOP leadership highlighted more money to hire about 2,000 more Border Patrol agents. Democrats are boasting of a $1 billion increase for Head Start programs and new child care centers for military families. They also played up a $120 million increase in funding for cancer research and a $100 million increase for Alzheimer's research. The spending package largely tracks with an agreement that then-Speaker Kevin McCarthy of California worked out with the White House in May 2023, which restricted spending for 2 years and suspended the debt ceiling into January 2025, so the federal government can continue paying its bills. Prospects for a short-term government shutdown had appeared to grow Friday evening after Republican and Democrats battled over proposed amendments to the bill. But shortly before midnight, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced a breakthrough. "It is good for the country that we have reached this bipartisan deal. It wasn't easy, but tonight our persistence has been worth it," Schumer said. The House passed the legislation Friday morning by a vote of 286 to 134, narrowly gaining the two-thirds majority needed for approval. The vote tally in the House reflected anger among Republicans over the content of the package and the speed with which it was brought to a vote. Johnson brought the measure to the floor, even though a majority of Republicans ended up voting against it. He said afterwards that the bill represents the best achievable outcome in a divided government. In sign of the conservative frustration, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, initiated an effort to oust Johnson as the House began to vote, but held off on further action until the House returns in 2 weeks. "It's the same tool that was used last year to remove McCarthy." The vote breakdown showed 110 Republicans voting for the bill and 112 voting against it. Meanwhile, 185 Democrats voted for the bill and 22 voted against it. Well, to continue our spate of unfortunate and interesting articles from military.com, we come to Air Force General charged with sexual assault pleads not guilty ahead of June trial date. Military.com, Thomas Novelli, published March 22, 2024. A two-star general who was relieved of command from the 19th Air Force at Joint Base San Antonio in Texas last year, amid charges of sexual assault and other crimes, pleaded not guilty to the allegations in court and is still seeking the opportunity to potentially retire ahead of his trial. Major General Philip A. Stewart pleaded not guilty and requested a jury panel for his trial during a hearing at Joint Base San Antonio on Thursday. An Air Force Air Education and Training Command spokesman confirmed this to military.com. Stewart's case marked the second time in history that an Air Force general officer has been formally charged with a sexual crime. The projected start date for the trial is June 17. Jeffrey Atticott, a professor of law and director of the Warrior Defense Project at St. Mary's University School of Law, and a member of Stewart's legal team, told Military.com on Friday that the request for retirement in lieu of court-martial they submitted in January is still in the works. In May, Air Education and Training Command announced that Stewart was being removed as commander of the 19th Air Force due to a loss of confidence in his ability to lead, related to alleged misconduct, which is currently under investigation. Subsequently, in October, he faced an Article 32 hearing, which is a preliminary hearing to a grand jury proceeding for civilians. Attica told Military.com in December that the judge for the Article 32 hearing had recommended that the sexual assault charges be dropped and the other charges not go to trial, but Lieutenant General Brian Robinson, head of Air Education and Training Command, referred the charges to a court-martial. They rendered a report saying that, in his opinion, he recommended to the convening authority that the more serious charges not go forward at all and that the other charges be disposed of administratively against General Stewart, Advocate said in December. That was his recommendation. It was not followed. It's highly unusual that convening authorities do not follow what the Article 32 officer recommends. Late last year, the Department of the Air Force told Special Trial Counselor became fully operational and was tasked with investigation and prosecution of 14 categories of offenses from under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. These included sex-related crimes. Had Stewart faced charges this year instead of last, that office, instead of the head of Air Education and Training Command, would have recommended whether the charges should go on to court-martial. A redacted charge sheet provided to Military.com in October by the command outlines the alleged misconduct. Stewart faces a dereliction of duty charge in which he is accused of failing to refrain from pursuing an unprofessional relationship. Additionally, the charge sheet details that he allegedly failed to refrain from assuming control of an aircraft after consuming alcohol within 12 hours prior to takeoff. The two-star also faces sexual assault charges and is alleged to have committed a sex act on a person at or near Altus Air Force Base in Oklahoma without her consent. And Stewart was charged with conduct unbecoming an officer near Denver, Colorado, while on official travel, in which he allegedly wrongfully invited an individual to spend the night alone with him in his private hotel room. The charge sheet had this also. Stewart also faces an extramarital sexual conduct charge. The charge sheet redacts the names of those involved in the alleged incidents. Military.com does not identify victims of sexual assault. It is a rarity for general officers to face court-martial. The first Air Force general to face court-martial proceedings was Major General Donald Kaufman in 1992 over allegations that he took war trophies from the Persian Gulf War and went on unnecessary temporary duty trips. Stars and Stripes reported that. He was arraigned, but the case was dismissed, and he did not face a jury. Kaufman was demoted in rank to colonel through non-judicial punishment and allowed to retire. In 2022, then Major General William Cooley, head of the Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, was convicted of abusive sexual contact in a court-martial. He was the first ever Air Force general to be tried for sexual crimes and convicted in a court-martial. A judge sentenced Cooley to forfeit $10,910 of pay for 5 months, and he was also given a letter of reprimand from the court-martial convening authority. Then Air Force Material Command Chief General Arnold Brunch Cooley was not sentenced to jail, but faced a maximum sentence of 7 years of confinement, separation and loss of pay and benefits. He ultimately retired as a colonel. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall will be in charge of approving or denying Stewart's request to retire. Kendall was asked about Stewart's case by military.com during a media roundtable at the Air and Space Force Association's conference in Colorado last month, where he said he did not believe it was representative of a cultural issue in the service's general officer corps. "I don't think it's representative of a larger issue," Kendall said during the media roundtable. "General Stewart has not been convicted yet, so I don't want to say anything about his guilt or innocence. We take these cases incredibly serious." Well, that's going to be the end of this issue. Be good to yourself. We'll talk again next time. Take care. Again, this is Bob Mallon, military.com website, presenting military news.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.